Welcome back to another episode of the Strange Motion Way podcast. I am Tim Strange with my co-host,
Carrie Strange, Turbo, and Axel.
They're running around here trying to figure out why we are talking to ourselves. This is part two of three parts in total with Daryl Starbird.
We did this podcast a year ago in Afton, Oklahoma at Daryl's house. So we were sitting in his dining room on this interview.
And he was 89 years old at the time. Here we go for part two.
My first car, and of course I bought it with my own money, and it was a pretty high-priced car for them days, and a very nice car, because it was
about, 41. Do you know what year that was?
41. Well, that was in, I just turned 16, so it would have been 33 to 16, and be 49, I guess.
So it wasn't it wasn't even a 10-year-old car yet when you bought that.
It was a pretty nice car.
Yeah.
And during the war, see, that car would have been very popular and high priced because it didn't build cars for 5 years.
Right. Yeah. They built some, just not that many.
Well, most of them Army.
Yeah.
My
story here, not to interrupt some of yours, was my grandpa was a military guy.
Okay.
And his father, so my great-grandpa was clergy. Well, you could get a new car if certain things during war,
okay,
if you were a preacher in the clergy. So he had one of those. Well, my grandpa was just a private. Well, he would drive his dad's car back to the military base, and everybody would salute him because they're thinking he's a high-ranking official because he's got a brand new car. Well, it had wood bumpers on it because you got a certificate and you had to go back later because they didn't have the metal for the bumpers. They had a new car because he was clergy with wooden bumpers on it.
Okay, that had to be in 42.
It was 42 or 3, I think the car was that he had. So,
42, they started making cars again.
Okay.
Excellent. Yeah.
So, did you customize that first 41 Ford? Or?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What'd you do on that first car?
It was a beast.
Yeah.
No, as I look back, the worst part about it, I never took a picture of this car finished. I had the picture when I first bought it. I put skirts on it and lowered it a little bit. And I lowered it by putting sandbags in the trunk. That's all the way I lowered it. And then when I actually customized it completely, took not just skirts and lowering them. I'd hate to tell you this because you're going to laugh. I actually put a 48 Chrysler bumper on the back of it. And I did this because I wanted to put a Continental kit on the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a Continental kit standing up on the trunk, and that 48 Chrysler bumper would come clear back to the edge of the fender. So I actually had a Continental kit lowered, and it was a rowboat looking, or not a rowboat, but a motorboat.
Tail dragger.
Because that was the thing in them days, a tail dragger, Everybody liked them lowered in the back instead of the front. And so I was the only one, there was two of us in high school, period, that had any kind of a custom car. And I had the most radical one. I painted it black. And 49 Ford had just come out when I did this. And I took the ball out of the middle of the grill and welded. I put the panel in the 41 center grill, had three grills. One was up down, two on each side.
Mm-hmm.
The center one, I put a ball in the middle of it, like off the Ford.
Yep.
And I welded that, it brazed that in, and then dressed it all out nice. Painted it all.
So did you have your own welding equipment? Or did you borrow a shop's welding equipment? Or
my dad had a mechanic shop to begin with.
Okay.
He had his own acetylene welding equipment. The only trouble was the torch was about 4 foot long. It was a railroad type, big old torch.
Yeah.
And the flame was about this big around.
And you're probably 5 foot tall at this time.
Yeah. So anyway, I could weld pretty good. But we did have an arc welder too, a real stick arc welder, or he did. And so I had both those. I did the framework if I did any with a stick welder. And but I braided almost everything because I knew how to braise better than anything, brass. And back in them days, all the companies, major companies, braised all the seams, spot welder, or spot welder if not braised. But almost all your early cars had brass everywhere.
Yeah.
Of course, you know.
So when did you start working on cars for your buddies or neighborhood guys?
Well, when I went to Boeing to work for them. As soon as I turned 18, I started working at Boeing Aircraft. And I was going to school. And at that time, I'd already built that 41 Ford. But then when I went to college, I went to work at Boeing about the same time. And at Boeing, I was going to be an aeronautical engineer, actually.
Is that what you were going to school for, too, and working at Boeing at the same time?
Right. And I was working third shift at Boeing, midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning, third shift, so I could go to school. And Boeing wanted engineers so bad that they wanted them so bad that they would treat us. There's about six of us who were all going to be aeronautical engineers. So they would, and at the time I hated it, they would put us in different departments because third shift was always a makeup shift. Whenever one department got low or got too much work and needed it, we'd be switched over to that department. So when I went there, I was there for 3 years, got 100 hours in. I thought all the time, I'm going to be an aeronautical engineer and I'm going to be sitting in a desk. And I'm down here bucking roots and dressing out dyes. And I worked in six different departments. I worked fiberglass, metal sheet metal assembly. I built dyes. Dress dies, Kirksite dies. I worked in a machine shop. I worked in a plaster pattern shop. I worked in a engineering, of course, finally, as a draftsman. And, well, anyway, every one of those deals at the time, I hated it because I thought I was waste my time that I wanted to be an engineer. Well, as it turned out,
little did you know you were learning all these skills to help you build all these cars all these years later.
Every one of them things worked right into what I decided to do, and I never even planned it that way.
Yeah,
but it just happened that way. And so my point being is, even though I'm about 6 to 8 years younger, well, 6 years minimum younger than all the other guys, because they all started in about 48 or 49, and I never started working on a car until I was that age, so I'm actually about 6 to 8 years younger than all your more famous guys, but I was only in business about 2 years, well, at 54 to 48, maybe, so, or 68, it actually caught up with them, so to speak. I had as many stories in the magazines and pictures and everything as they did.
But so when was you first building customer cars? When did people start bringing
customer cars? And I started my shop in 54.
Okay.
And I went right into customer.
And you just left Boeing and says...
Right.
So how do you have that idea? People ask me that all the time. I started my shop when I was young. And obviously, there was a lot more shops around when I did it than when you... What did your family say when you, I'm quitting Boeing and I'm going to open a custom car shop?
Well, I already had 100 hours in, which I could graduate at 124 or 144 to be an aeronautical engineer. My dad had a heart attack when I dropped out of that, because that's what he always wanted me to be, because he was a supervisor at Boeing. And it worked his way up the hard way.
Yeah, and like I kind of went through that with my family some. You know, I worked in collision shops, but when I decided to do hot rods for a living, you know, my family were car people, that you had a real job and sure. hot rods were your hobbies. Right. It took quite a few years for my family to realize that, well, maybe they still maybe don't realize that I can do this for a living, but it's almost been 30 years. But it is, it's not a normal thing to say, I'm going to build hot rods or customs for a living, especially when you have all that Boeing stuff and you're close to graduating. I'm sure that was a, yeah, not a friendly time in the Starboard household, no, was it? Wasn't.
And also, I'll tell you how I quit. And one of the main reason I just quit one day, and boy, I had been working there for 3 years, and I had worked my way up to being a draftsman for an engineer. I moved out of the plant into the engineering department mm-hmm. as a draftsman, helping an engineer. And I was his helper, and each engineer had a draftsman that did the drawings and all of that type of stuff. Well, he come to me after I was with him for about a year. And he said, Darrell, I want you and my that department that he was in, that we did the power plant systems. We controlled all the fuel that went to the planes.
Yeah.
That's what our job, mm-hmm. all the valves and the tanks and anything had anything to do with the fuel system went through our department. And I was a draftsman for that department. So anyway, he come to me one day after about a year, I guess, and he said, Darrell, I want you to design me 3 valves to do this specific job. And he handed me a piece of paper and showed the specs that this job had to have to get fuel to the system. Just part of the system, of course. And he said, you got 6 weeks. 6 weeks, I want you to hand me 3 layouts. Specific design layouts. One of them out of the BAC book, which is Boeing Airplane Company, has a book about this thick, about this size, full of every part they ever put on an airplane. He says, I want you to pick one of them out of that book, about 3,000 names in that thing, that'll do this job. The other two, I want you to do your own design, just exactly the way you'd design it, and make it work. They had to work, of course. So I took that very serious. I mean, that went, boy, this is my first real true test of whether I have the ability to design something. You know? So the first week I spent of the 6 looking through the BAC book, and I found a valve that would do every bit of this. It's already made, ready to go. All I had to do is order it from another company. And so then I spent the next 5 weeks designing my own 2 designs. And I took it so serious, I actually went down on the airplane and researched where it would go and how it would work and everything about it. Most engineers don't bother to do that, do all by book. I mean, but I actually went right down there and faced on for several days and studied the whole situation. Because unlike most guys my age in that situation, they didn't do any of that. You didn't go down in the plant, but I did because I'd worked down there mm-hmm. much before that 3 years. So anyway, I walked into him 6 weeks later, or he come back to my desk. After I had my own desk, he had his own desk. Come back to my desk, and he says, Darrell, you got those valves ready for me. I got to have them today. I said, oh, yeah, they're ready right now. I've had them ready for several days because I knew 6 weeks I had to have them. Mm-hmm. So I handed them to him, all 3 of them, the drawings. Detailed drawing, perfect. Had to be within 5 thousandths of an inch laid out. I handed them to him, and he goes, this paper's about this big. He looks at that thing like this. Boy, you did a great job. That's something, original design. Boom, in the wastebasket. Mm-hmm. That kind of shocked me, you know. My original design just went in the wastebasket. And so he looked at the next one. My God, I believe I did the job great. That's great. In the wastebasket. That really shocked me. The third one's a BAC book we already had made. He looked at it and said, this will do fine. I said, this will do fine, and I just designed 2 that will do a better job, I think. He says, yeah, and I says, I'll see you. I walked out and never went back to Boeing.
How long were you at Boeing?
I was at Boring for almost 3 years, a little over 3 years.
So you didn't like that, even though you were doing what you were supposed to do, that you're basically wasting your time?
Well, see, I always felt that I wanted to see something done, finished, mm-hmm. you know, and working. That was my whole objective. Being an engineer, I wanted to design a whole airplane. I didn't want to design a valve to begin with. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's my idea. And I would have seriously worked up to design an airplane. I mean, I was that dedicated to the whole thing. Well, it upset me so much that I just looked at my, or gave my thoughts. I says, I'm out of here. I'm gone. I walked out in the middle of the afternoon or middle of the evening because I was working. Well, I had already went to work on first shift then, which was 8 in the morning till 5. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was gone.
I had friends that worked in the GM design studio through the years, and that's the same reason they quit, you know, doing prototype designs, and they spend a year on this thing, but there's all these other teams doing stuff. And it's your team might get picked for the car, or you might get picked for the gauges, or he's like, I just felt like I was wasting my life there. And, you know, some people's dream job, like working at Boeing would be some people's dream job. Yeah. But were you already at this time already working on customer cars and customs? You knew that you didn't need that Boeing job?
Yeah, right. I had already, as a matter of fact, I had already done a couple cars for just close friends, you know, the end of my dad's garage, you know. Even when I was in high school, I did some stuff for other people, but not paid, just friend type stuff. And they didn't really get too radical.
So you learned early on, you don't want to work for friends and family because they don't pay you. I learned that early on.
And even friends are bad about it. Like you say, they'll say, oh, well, hey, that was good. Thank you.
So did you already have a workspace, a shop that you were doing stuff on the off hours at that time? Or when you left Boeing that day, did you figure out?
That's when I actually rented my first shop.
Was as soon as you left Boeing. You didn't even have a shop rented yet.
Well, let me back up a bit. That's not true. When I was still at Boeing, and I still before I even got transferred to the engineering department, another friend of mine that worked in the same department I did and was going to be an engineer, him and I actually rented a building right next door to the Ford Motor Company or Ford dealership, an old beat-up building that had been cut to left, and him and I rented it to work on cars part-time, mm-hmm. even though I was going to school and already working at Boeing. I also decided I had time to work on cars. I don't know how, but I did. And so him and I began working on cars, and then we didn't have enough tools to really do too much like we needed to do, so I had another friend that worked at Boeing that always, his dad was a body man. And he had a lot of tools, but he had just closed his shop and went to work for Boeing, kind of like my dad did. Mm-hmm. Well, I said, hey, bud, we need tools. You want to be our third partner? Mm-hmm. So he actually jumped in then after we had it for a few days or a few months, actually. And so he brought a lot of tools with him, a lot of stuff we didn't have.
Did you have a name for the shop at this point, or you just a few buddies working on cars?
We didn't even have a name. Yeah. We didn't really work on cars except for people we knew or somebody asked us to, you know. We bought it or had it mainly for ourselves. Mm-hmm. I built some of that 41 Ford there. I'll take that back. I'd already got into the later model stuff. But
then as soon as you left Boeing, you never looked back, really, did you?
Started. I just quit.
Is that when Star Custom, you named it then? Are you still partnered with those guys after you left Boeing and doing this full time?
Actually, what happened on the three guys was I was working third shift, and the other guy was working, I was working first shift because I was already in the engineering department. Mm-hmm. And he was working third shift still. And the other, both, one of them just quit right in the very beginning. He worked a few months maybe or so, and he just didn't have, he's working Boeing too at the same time, but on third shift when I was. And he went to work and he called me up at Boeing, which you don't ever call anybody at Boeing, but it's an emergency. He told him it was an emergency. So he called me up and he says, "Daryl, I just got shot and I don't feel good at all." And I said, "You just got shot?" He says, "Yeah, I'm water sanding this car right in the water." You know, in them days, metal tools, mm-hmm. you know, and they weren't grounded real good, mm-hmm. most of them. I mean, you didn't stay in the water anyway and try to sand, you know. And so he says, "I don't feel very good. What do you think I should do?" And I said, "Well, I'll see if I can't get off and come help you, you know." So by the time I checked out and went down there, I got down there and the guy's laying on the dead, laying on the floor, almost dead. I mean, he died right there if I hadn't come.
Yeah.
I called an ambulance. They took him to the hospital immediately. His heart had just stopped completely. They actually got him back to life, though.
Oh, wow.
And put him on a receptor type thing and pounding on him when he got there. They started pounding on him and hauled him off the hospital. I thought he was gone. Mm-hmm. I didn't have no doubts. Anyway, they brought him back and got him working all right.
It's a good thing you got out of work.
Oh, well, if I hadn't left work, he'd have died right there.
Yeah.
Within minutes. You know, that's what I said. If you'd have been 10 minutes later, he wouldn't be here. So that was kind of God sent, to say the least. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, he quit. I mean, he didn't ever come back, period. But he still loved cars and worked on cars, but he never did come back to that shop. And so I had to shop by myself at this point. Well, I didn't really need it that bad because I had my shop at home to work in if I needed to, you know. So I dropped out of the shop at that time. This is a little bit before I quit Boeing, actually. And I didn't quit Boeing and started up Star Custom Shop. And that's what I called it, Star Custom Shop.
And that was what year? 54?
That was 54.
54.
Mm-hmm. And I started doing custom work right away, and I wanted to do all custom work, and I had already talked to enough guys at Boeing. See, another aspect of that I didn't fulfill you on was when I was in high school, I was actually a junior in high school, I had bought like 41 Chevys and 41 Fords that needed work on them, you know, and I'd sell them when I was a junior in high school, even when I was, this is right before I went to work for Boeing, actually. Is that right? They were real close, same time, really. And so I'd bought one and sell it. And, you know, I'm talking about $200-$300 cars. $400-$500 cars. Mm-hmm. I'd paint the fenders. I'd use a fly spray. They didn't mm-hmm. have spray cans. Mm-hmm. But the old-fashioned pumping fly sprays, mm-hmm. that's what I painted fenders with, a lot of them. That's where I learned to paint. And I guess you'd call it learn. You don't want to paint that way. But anyway, they worked as good as a spray can, believe it or not. And a heck of a lot cheaper than they are now, of course. But anyway, I built about five or six of them and went down to get a license for them, of course, to sell them. And then when I got there, the guy says, "I'm going to give you one more." But he says, "From now on, you can't sell them if you're going to put them, because you can only do three cars a year when you don't have a D tag." And so I said, "Well, how do I get a D tag?" He said, "Don't ask me. I don't know. I just work here." So I went back to the house and I told Dad, I said, "I can't even build cars anymore because they won't let me sell them. I got to run through somebody's name, not mine." You know. I said, "How do you get a D tag? What is a D tag exactly?" I didn't even know what it meant, really. Well, he said, "You know, it's got D on it. It says dealer. And all dealers have D tags, and usually three or four or five of them." And I said, "Well, how do you get them?" And he said, "Well, you just go down to the place and fill out a blank for it, or bring the blank home and fill it out." So I go down there in a couple of days like a dummy, because I was still in high school. I fill out this paper, everywhere it said on it, location, I put the house, which we lived in a suburban area. Mm-hmm. I put the house down the address. Wherever it said age, I left it blank. I just left it blank, and my own age, and filled it all out. Quite a few blanks on it left blank, so I thought, I showed it to Dad. He says, that'll never go through. You got to have every one of them filled up. I said, I don't have nothing to put there, you know. And so anyway, I turn it in, then son of a gun, 3 days, about a week later, I get 3 D tags in the mail.
Oh, wow.
Saying you're a Kansas registered dealer.
Yeah.
It's because I sent the money right along with it. $30 for a year, which is a lot of money in them days. I mean, in comparison. And so I was still a junior in high school, and I had a deed to Kansas registered dealer. So I began, even though I was working at Boeing and going to college, I was also selling cars,
yeah,
you know, one at a time type thing. But at that point, I went to Dad and I said, Dad, I could really make some money if I had some money to buy regular cars, you know, not old beat up cars. I was making $100, $200 or $300. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was good money when I was in high school because I was always ahead of everybody. I always had more money than anybody, but I earned it. And so he says, well, there's this thing as a floor plan. And I said, what the heck's a floor plan? He says, well, almost all dealers have their own floor plan. They go to a bank, and the bank gives them a floor plan, and it says your limit is $10,000, $100,000, whatever it was, depending on who they were. So I was going home from high school one day at 3 o'clock, and I saw this big sign right there on Douglas where I went by. I never noticed it. It said, Midwest Finance Company. I thought, I'm going to go in there and get me a floor plan. I'm by myself in my 41 Ford. So I go in there and I walk in the front door and I'm that old. And there's a lady sitting there waiting on you, you know. And I walk in there and she says, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I want to be get me a floor plan. I'm a dealer. Mm-hmm. She looks at me like, are you crazy? I says, yeah, I want to get a floor plan for a dealer because I'm a Kansas registered dealer. And she said, you what? And I said, yeah, I'm a Kansas registered car dealer. And she said, how old are you? I think I said 17 or 16 or whatever it was, 15 maybe, I don't know. Anyway, behind her was a glass-in office. Sitting at that glass-in office was a bank officer.
Mm-hmm.
You do this, I mean, or what do I have to do? And he says, you don't know who I am, but remember your dog? And I said, yeah, I remember my dog. Family dog, mm-hmm, called Tiny, little mutt. Been with us for 10 years or something. And everybody was gone now. The kids were all, we were all four. I was the only one living at the house. My little brother got killed on the motor scooter. Mm-hmm. My big brother got killed on a motor wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And during this time. And so my dog was there alone, but he stayed outside. He's a little tiny dog, but when we were home, he would be inside, mm-hmm, sometimes, you know, but most of the time he's outside. Well, he got the habit of going down to the neighbor's house, which is about, from here to the shop, mm-hmm, away, a couple hours between there and there. But he would go down there, and the lady that lived there would take him in and pet him and, mm-hmm, become a real friend. And he got to where he was staying down there, fenced in a backyard,
mm-hmm,
more than he was coming home. And I'd go down there. I went down there once or twice probably to get my dog because I knew where he's at. But I was going to school and doing all this, mm-hmm, other stuff too. You know? And so the last time I went down there, I brought my dog home. The next day I get a letter in the mail. The mail comes from the father, or from the husband because it only had one baby. Didn't have no kids. Mm-hmm. She had three miscarriages. The lady did. And it affected her a little bit mentally, mm-hmm. you know. Upset her terrible. The miscarriages did. And she wanted kids real bad. So she adopted my dog as a baby. Really. Mm-hmm. That's what it amounted to. In the letter it says, told the whole story of what her problem was. It says, every time you come get that dog, my wife, believe it or not, ends up in bed. That's how bad it affects her. He says, I'm enclosing $100 in this envelope. And
to buy the dog,
take
you.
The $100 and take the dog, wasn't worth nothing. I mean, in them days, you could get much for nothing. People pay to take home. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought, I can't sell my family dog. How do you do that? You know, I'm the only one left. And so I went to the folks, and, you know, when they came home, I said, I got this letter today, and it says, you give me $100 for this dog. Well, I was going with Donna. I just started going with Donna not too long. I told her about it. She said, you ain't going to sell your heavy dog, are you? And I said, well, I ain't going to sell it. But on the other hand, this lady gets sick when I come mm-hmm. get her. What do I do? So anyway, I gave it a lot of thought. I finally took the $100. Let her keep my dog. But he, from then on, I heard, yeah, you sold your family dog.
Yeah, but you helped her because she needed that dog as like a therapy dog, really.
That's right,
so.
She did. And I really didn't have much choice.
And this was the guy that wrote you the letter, was the bank guy.
Right. That was the father of the...
So he remembered that favor that you did for his family.
That's right.
And it helped you get your...
And he gave me a floor plan.
Yeah.
He actually gave me a floor plan at that age. And he says, I'll give you whatever you want to buy your cars, but you've got to put 15% of your own money down first. You come up 15%, I'll come up with 85% of whatever you want to buy. Mm-hmm. But he says, you got 90 days to pay me back. The first time you don't pay me back in 90 days, the floor plan is gone. Mm-hmm. This was conditions. Well, that guy was with me for all the way through high school.
Wasn't this the same guy, too, that helped you with your car shows and your loans and all that? Same guy was with you for many, many years.
So. Many years.
Yeah.
And he finally died. When he died, I lost my floor plan, of course.
Yeah.
Because they sold his company. Well, when I talked to my banker or talked to my regular banker, which by this time I had a Fourth National Bank, too, in Wichita, which is the biggest bank in Wichita. But they were just limited. They loaned me money per car and mm-hmm. so forth, you know, or whatever I needed. But anyway, the president of that bank I got to know pretty well because he also owned a sport boat travel show there in town. Mm-hmm. The bank president did. And the owner of the bank, really. And he'd call me up and say, I need a car, you know, to use in my show. Well, before I ever did a car show, I was doing shows for him with my cars, just letting him use them and take pictures of them, do stories for him and that type of stuff. He got to know me pretty well, and I liked him. He liked me. He called me up, and he says, Daryl, you need a floor plan. And I said, yeah. And he said, you got it right here at Fourth National Bank. I'll give you a limit of $500,000 floor plan.
Wow.
I said, what? $500,000? So... He gave it to me. I had that floor plan for good guys most of my life. Even when I built my next big shop and everything, he still gave me a floor plan. So he was my next lifesaver. And this, I just fell into these things. I mean, just happened to be at the right place.
So you mentioned, jump back a little bit, you were dating Donna when you sold the dog.
Right.
So when did you guys get married?
We were 19 when we got married.
So you were still working at Boeing when you guys got married?
Right, yeah.
Did she think you were crazy when you were going to run a custom shop? Or is she, I mean, we all know her as the most supportive hot rod, the queen of customs, that's what I called her. And, of course, she's not with us anymore. She was your shadow right-hand person in charge of you, your supervisor.
Exactly.
And so was she very supportive for the custom cars right from the start? Or she's like, I don't know if you should quit this Boeing job.
Well, she definitely said that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know whether...
Did you have any kids at this time?
No.
No kids yet?
No kids. We didn't have any kids for 4 years. And it wasn't because we didn't want them, but just God didn't want us to have them because I had me investigated because she thought maybe I was sterile, you know, and couldn't have kids because mm-hmm. she wanted kids, right? First year.
Mm-hmm.
Her whole ambition was to have 5 boys. I mean, that was her whole plan in life because we're Catholic, of course. And, or she was, I wasn't. So anyway, when we got married, she thought that she's marrying somebody who's going to be aeronautical engineer, I'm sure. But then when I told her I quit and I went to work, you know, going to start my shop up, Dad come unglued. I mean, he told me I was the craziest man in the world, I mean, or a boy. Because he says, you got 100 hours in, you're going to be an aeronautical engineer, you'll be set for life. And I said, well, but I won't be doing what I want to do,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I told her the same thing. I said, you can walk, and I don't blame you, you know, because I'm not going to be what you thought I'd be. But in the meantime, she actually worked third shift or worked weekends at Woolworths, which is a big mm-hmm. grocery or clothing store downtown. So she also had a part-time job when we were in high school and even into college. And so she had saved up her money too, and she had enough money to buy stuff on her own because she had a little bank account. And I had saved money myself because I sold all these cars. I made money all the time on them. I actually bought my first house before we ever got married.
Mm-hmm.
And I made down when the car market began getting flooded right after the war was over. All the companies started building cars again and began the car market was hard to deal in anymore for me because that year car was just about, had been used during the war and you couldn't hardly sell them anymore because now they could buy a new car
mm-hmm.
and get a loan on it. The older cars, you couldn't get any loans on. So it kind of hurt me as a business, in the car mm-hmm. business. See, the only thing I ever wanted at that point in life was to have a new car dealership of my own.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was working toward. But when the car market went kaboom on me, the used car market, that I'm dealing in. The last car I bought and really did it good on was my supervisor at Boeing, the guy I worked under, before I went in the engineering department. Him and I got to be pretty good friends because he made me the lead man on third shift.
Mm-hmm.
And he never stayed on third shift. He'd just leave it whole. And I had 6 guys under me. And they were all older. And I was a kid almost. And I was their lead man, which none of them liked very much. But anyway, that same supervisor wanted to buy a new Ford. And he said to me, he said, I know you're still dealing cars. Or do you still deal in cars? And I said, yeah. And he said, I want a new Ford. I can't get one. And without a long waiting. So I said, don't worry about it. I'll get you one. So I went to Kansas City and I bought a car off the auction. A new car, and because I had a D-tag,
mm-hmm.
and I brought it back and I sold it to him, and he traded in a 49 Ford for it, and I fixed it up and sold it, made good money on both projects, even though I was still doing all these other things too. I don't know how I do all this as I look back on it,
mm-hmm.
but I sold that one, and that was the last used car I actually sold for anybody. At that point, I turned it to my whole life to shop
mm-hmm.
and build the customs. And I built numerous early customs that were in all the magazine.
What was your first magazine car?
First magazine car would have been, I'll tell you a little bit of story about that. I built a 55 Plymouth, which is almost brand new for another friend that I'd met through the other car. And he just bought a new 55 Plymouth, and he gave it to his son for graduation. And it was a 55 Plymouth, two-door. And then also, he brought it to me, and I customized it. The son did. His father wasn't really much for it, playing with the dealership. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they had plenty of money. I customized it, and that was the first car, two cars. I also had built a 47 Cadillac, a fastback, mm-hmm. that I owned myself and drove and customized. One of my first customers, really, that I actually took pictures of and mm-hmm. used as a shop car, you know. And it made all, and those two cars happened to be at Manhattan, Kansas, at a real small car show. I'd been winning car shows all over the place back in there, but I never could get them in a magazine because they wouldn't come out there and shoot them.
Yeah, the magazines were very California-based, weren't they? So it was very hard for a middle-of-the-country guy to get print.
I just didn't get any print work. Yeah. So Spence Murray, which was the editor of the magazine at that mm-hmm. time, and Rod and Custom was the big magazine. If you got on Rod and Custom, you were halfway home, I mean, you know. So he had the Dream Truck, or Rod and Custom Dream Truck. Mm-hmm. It was probably the most famous truck ever made.
Yep.
And he was taking it back to a guy named Botts in the Chicago area to put fins on it. This guy was in Chicago, was an unbelievable metal man. He didn't do too many customs, but boy, he could do metal work. Mm-hmm. So Spence took the Dream Truck. After, see, the idea of the Dream Truck is to do magazine articles.
Yep.
And they just did them step by step, and they had different customizers do each part of it. So about everybody worked on it, but I didn't, because nobody heard of me or mm-hmm. knew me, you know. So he's on his way there with the Dream Truck. I said to him, he stopped at the show, and he come in there and he saw my two cars. He said, where the heck these cars come from? And I said, well, I have a shop about 100 miles from here, Star Custom Shop. Mm-hmm. He said, well, why haven't we been covering your car? And I said, because you're just darn cheap to come back here and mm-hmm. do it. And he said, well, gee, you're right. We don't have no budget to come back to do any cars. You either got to send the pictures there or you're not going to get no coverage. Mm-hmm. He said, I said, well, what do I have to do? And he said, you go buy the best camera you can buy, which is a Rolleiflex, which was $350, which is like $35,000 to me yeah. at that time. I mean, I go down and I spend my money, which Donna had a fit. And or, I guess it was Donna. Anyway, somebody had a fit that I spent that kind of money on a camera. I took that camera, put it on a tripod, and I shot everything I ever did on a car from then on with that mm-hmm. camera. And I sent every one of them pictures of Spencer.
So your first magazine feature, did Spencer shoot them pictures?
No, I did.
You shot them, okay.
Spence went on.
But he says, yes, send us pictures. We like your work. So that chance meeting at that small car show, him passing through is what lit a fire under your career, basically. Yeah.
I'd already built those two nice cars, mm-hmm. but I couldn't get no coverage on them because I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And I didn't even own
Yeah, people nowadays, they don't understand. There's still magazines around, but I mean, that started my business too. The first time I got in a car magazine, 3 months later, I was running my shop full time.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what happened. I mean, magazines, every time I had something in a magazine, the phone would just ring off the hook. So,
That made you.
Yeah.
I even got the distinct that when I walked into Peterson Publishing, they gave me an office to write stories every time I was out there.
Yeah. What year was your first car in a magazine? Late 50s?
Yeah, would have been 56 maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. That I actually had a car in there. Maybe then, 57.
You know, a lot of people know, we might jump ahead a little bit here, but you did the Predicta. Mm-hmm. Which was the first bubble top car.
Right.
And that was kind of, I mean, as a younger guy that didn't grow up, I wasn't born until the 70s.
Yeah.
That's the first car that I remember kind of knowing you from was sure. the Predicta. And that was done in what, 61?
59.
Oh, 59. Okay.
58. Well, I built the car in 59 and took it to Oakland in 59.
Okay.
Grand National Roadster Show. But before that, I built a 57 Thunderbird for a guy named Bob Turgeon in Topeka, Kansas, called a Little Pearl. Mm-hmm. And it was on the cover of the magazine.
But it was not a bubble top, was it?
No, it was not. Okay. But it was a radical. 57 T-Bird.
Okay.
And it made all the magazines, and I took NSRA or MHR, but Drag Racer did the first show along with the drag race in Detroit.
Okay.
For the first year. And I took that car to that first car show, that T-Bird. Never, you know, and nobody ever customized late model T-Bird.
Yeah.
And I won that show over everybody. The A Brothers were supposed to win it with a little pickup they'd built. And they were strong in Detroit. Mm-hmm. But I, of course, I never been to Detroit.
Yeah.
Where that goes. So I won it. And so when I won that, they gave me a custom car shop of the year, mm-hmm. the magazine did, and ran all my stories that year, Rod and Custom. And they were the ones, or no, Carcraft, I'm sorry, Carcraft magazine ran that show.
Okay.
And that's when I changed over to Dick Day, which was editor of Carcraft. He took me under his wing and started running all them covers.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Day did.
Okay.
From Peterson. And I had about 5 covers in a row that just changed the whole industry.
And then you when you did the Predicta, where did the idea for the bubble top and that car had stick steering? Did that come from the Boeing stuff in your mind, being around the airplanes and stuff? You said, I'm going to build a bubble top like an airplane and the stick steering. Did that come from?
Well, I would say more is that inspired me.
Yeah.
You know, that made me think about aerodynamics and the shape of modern cars. And that became a big part of my business. I was never an illustrator. I'm never very good at drawing.
Mm-hmm.
I always did all my cars. In fact, almost every magazine you saw that had an illustration in it, the car had already been built. And the illustration was made off the car, off of something I told them.
Okay.
Because I built my cars out of tubing first, conduit, the better cars.
Mm-hmm.
And the conduit, I would get the shape I wanted, full size.
Mm-hmm.
So I got 3D dimensional shape in my mind, or even a designer on paper. Quite often the car, when you build it, isn't what you thought it would be.
Yeah, and a lot of people now, they work off renderings, but I was just out at Marcel's shop.
Mm-hmm.
Right before the Roadster show, I went and had an open house, and he built a car for himself, and that's exactly how he did it. He started with a free form because he's building it for himself, didn't have to have a customer approval, and then at the end, before he started skinning it, he did have Chip Foose come in, and Chip just moved a couple things around and added, changed the cockpit opening, but yeah, he's still doing it. He didn't use flat steel and round steel to build this body buck, but same type of thing. He's still doing that same like you did. You build it out of conduit and it's like seeing it what you wanted before you skinned it. And
sure.
Yeah, the guys are still doing that today.
Yeah, I went to Marcel's shop and he talked to me about all that before they ever built a bubble top car.
So, mm-hmm.
Or built cars for what's his name?
Yeah, he was building for Boyd and Rick Dorr and
Dorr.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But anyway,
about this time, in that era, model car kits were very big. That's why I started building model car kits.
Right.
What was your first model car? Your car that you built became a model car. I know later times there was a vice versa that the big T was built as a model and they hired you to build the car in real life. Is that correct?
Well, not exactly. What actually happened?
So first, what was your first model car, the car you built that became a model car?
The first car that I built, period, was the big T. That become a model car.
Okay.
Because they hired me in the middle of them building the big T or having a drawing zone.
Which I told that speech when you inducted me in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, right.
I got that big T model, and that was my bribery in grade school to learn my multiplication and division for math class. I always wanted that big T model. My parents says, well, you learn your math. You know, because I was always a hands-on out in the farm and stuff, and I didn't want to do bookwork. So that was my bribe, that if I learned by the time the big test was and passed, they bought me that big T model kit.
Oh, good.
So I got it, and I built that, and it's fallen apart, but I still have that car today. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
That's great. I then even though the car was already on a drawing board, they hired me right in the middle of it. And it was actually in construction at that time. The guy that drew it up and designed it, I did a lot of little changes on it, even at that point, mm-hmm. just small things I didn't think looked right, especially the stance. He had the thing way up in the air. Mm-hmm. I put it down on the ground. But every piece of that big T, later I built a replica of it to use because I needed one on my shows and all.
Mm-hmm.
So I first built the replica, or the clone, whatever you want to call it. And I used all used parts that I got out of salvage yards, which they had drawers, most of them, because they got the ideas off of mm-hmm. the salvage car. So the original big T was actually built for them, but after the model was already out.
Okay.
So,
and how many of your cars end up being model cars through your career?
At least a dozen.
Yeah.
And another four or five were never actually built in the cars. They were done on just me standing telling the engineer what I wanted. Mm. They're all T's.
No.
Well, not really. A 44 truck. There's four or five more models put out that I designed that were never made into cars.
Yeah.
And then I had a 3-year contract with Monogram originally, 3 years. And then I extended it 4 more, so I had it for 7 years, actually.
Oh, wow.
And first contract was for 3.
Did they just pay you per car? Or did you get like a commission on model sales?
Well, I got paid me for the car. Plus, uh-huh. I got a small amount on each car.
Yeah.
Not much. You know, 2 or 3 cents on a little model car.
Yeah.
The big model, I got 8 cents or something.
Yeah.
That's all I got, even though it sold for $9.95.
Yeah, it's like a musician selling music. You know, the actual guy doing the music part doesn't get much money. So, right. Yeah.
Same thing, exactly. And I... instead of copyrighting the models, you can't really put a patent on anything. I mean, in essence, all you can do is do a copyright on design.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult to get a patent on something because somebody's already made it, you know, down the line somewhere. So most of my cars are all copyrighted by Monogram, and a few of them I put my name on, the better ones.
Mm-hmm.
The big Deuce, I had my name on it. I didn't have it on the big T. But about every model after that, at least I had the mm-hmm. copyright on the design itself.
Cool.
Even the last 10 years of not getting anything from it, because Monogram actually sold to Mattel.
Oh, okay.
And Mattel kind of, instead of taking me on and paying me like Monogram was, they decided they would just rename the little coffin something different and use my design because I didn't have no control over that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they kind of found out that I had control over it and started paying me for it. But the first 4 years, so they could use the name Little Coffin, because I had to name Little Coffin copyrighted, mm-hmm. but I didn't have a design. You can't copyright a design. You got to copy, you know, the looks of it. Yeah. I mean, you can't copy the car itself.
Yeah.
Just say, I got a car, I want to copy. I mean, can't do that.
Which anyway, that car was a Hot Wheels car, too.
Right, and a hot rod,
yeah. And they call it the Little Coffin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, they actually started paying me then, Monogram did.
So when Mattel got involved, how many of your cars were Hot Wheels cars?
Actually, 100% true Hot Wheel car. The only one was the Little Coffin.
Okay. Because I know you're in the Diecast Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you sold so many of a car that you did. Was that what got you into that?
9 million of them.
Oh, my goodness.
9 million Hot Wheels. 9 million of one Hot Wheel. The most ever sold of any car in the world.
9 million Little Coffin Hot Wheels. Well, I probably have 6 of them, 10 of them probably. So. Yeah, right.
And that's the reason, when I got inducted in the Diecast Hall of Fame,
yeah,
it was me and I never can think of his name. He wore the cowboy hat that was rousing around. I had the Nationals.
I can't think. I'm blank right now.
Round and round drag race. Or not drag race.
Oh, Petty. Richard Petty?
Petty.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, it was Petty. Petty had it. He got his for diecast, too. He had six of them.
Yeah.
My one car outsold all six of his.
Wow.
Combined in numbers.
Yeah, and that's not anybody to sneeze at, Richard Petty. So,
that's right. That wasn't too good for Petty. He didn't like that, too. But he got the same ring I did.
Yeah.
We both got them the same place, same time.
That's cool.
In Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And I lose mine, darn. I'm going to try to get that rebate if I can find the design.
Anymore. Yeah. So, 3 years of running your shop, you had a lot of guys come and go. Who was, like, famous names that worked at your shop that maybe went on? David Stuckey worked for you?
David Stuckey worked for me for 10 years. I took him out of high school.
He was there when you built the little coffin, right? Or was that actually Stuckey's car? Okay.
That was actually his car.
Okay.
That's the reason his name's put to it. As much as mine, because it was his car to start, but he's working for me when he built it.
Yeah.
I built it along with him. He didn't even know how to weld when he come to work for me. He'd just been out of high school.
Yeah.
All he did is he took it to a friend of his, and he channeled it, took a torch, cut the body off, and welded it to the frame.
Yeah. Who else worked for you through those years that people would know the names?
Bill Cushenberry.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Cushenberry.
Where was Cushenberry
Tom
from?
Tom Hanna built dragsters.
Okay. Where was Cushenberry from? Was he a Kansas guy?
From Wichita.
Okay. I guess I didn't know that. I thought maybe he moved to work for you.
No, he was from Wichita, and he had a shop named Kansas Custom Shop.
Okay.
And he come over, first just dropped by and see me all the time. We got to be good friends. And when he went to California, originally, he never really worked for me that long. But when he went to California, he said he worked for me. That's how he got started. He said, I worked for Darryl Sarber. And that's when he got his shop in Monterey. Mm. And through my name, they hired him. I mean, the magazine started running stories, so they thought he was one of my employees. And they put in all their magazines, he was employed by me. He really wasn't that terrible. He had a shop down the street, and he used to come over at night and work for me at night because he didn't make money to eat. So anyway, he met this girl who used to come hang around my shop. Well, you know who she was, hung around the shop to see me. But I was a lot older than her. I mean, I was 30 probably, and she was like in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But her and another girl used to come hang. They liked cars. They used to hang around the shop, and I didn't really pay much
attention. Those girls are trouble that come around the hot rod shop.
Right.
I married one of those, so I can say that they're kind of trouble.
Well, yeah. Bill Cushenberry married one, too.
Yeah.
He took her to California.
Yeah.
And when he got to California, they got married. But he was already married, so he had to get a divorce. And she was just got out of high school when he took her out there. He could have went to jail, probably. Anyway, that was the same girl. And started his own shop up. And when I built the Predictive, believe it or not, I didn't. The bubble top was the first bubble top ever made in the business. You know?
Now, is this a story that, I don't know if this is wife's tale, or you told me that when you took that to the first show in California,
right,
the top sat beside the car.
Exactly. That's what I saw.
Got the top late, and then you mounted the top later. And you showed me one time there was a magazine article, like it was on the cover, that the hinging mechanism wasn't even done on it. It was just sitting on the car. So.
And see, I stopped in Bill Cushenberry's shop, and we cut the bottom of the bubble off and mounted it on the car, just set it on there. Took it on because I had it already had committed it for the next cover of Car Craft Magazine. Mm-hmm. So I had no choice but to be there to shoot it.
Yeah.
Well, I stopped the bills, cut the top on the bottom where you have to get it to fit to the body. we set it, Bill and I set it on top of the car, and I went on to California to shoot the pictures. When I got on down there, it wasn't even mounted to the car, actually just sitting on it. And the editor, if you look real close in the, on the magazine cover, the editor's got his hand like this, holding the top, and I got my hand over here holding the top.
Yeah.
And they're shooting the cover.
Yeah. So what did people think when you rolled that out, the trailer, or off the trailer?
Oh, my.
When you had this, I mean, let alone the bubble top, but that car was just crazy, hand-built.
Oh, yeah.
And just probably a crowd around it. They think you were crazy. They think you were from another planet. What was the thought process when you rolled out the Predictor the first time?
Everybody was totally amazed. I remember that. And they couldn't believe it, that I built something like that. Mm-hmm. You know? But it didn't have the top on it.
Yeah.
At that time, it didn't even set on there. Because I just got it. It just got to the day that we opened the shop. The show.
Yeah.
The whole crate. Because when I left her, I'd already blown two bubbles. They both wasn't any good.
Mm-hmm.
So the third bubble I left her, Dave Stuckey, actually had it. I had him try it one more time. And that one come out perfect, bubble itself.
Yeah.
The third try, though. Because, see, I had to make my own tool. I didn't even have a big enough oven. I had to make my own oven. I had to make an oven that would heat evenly because the plastic heats uneven. It blows wrong. The first two had flaws in it because I couldn't get the heat right.
Mm-hmm.
And I put burners in the bottom of it. Just old gas burners. I took out an old stove, and I put a quarter-inch plate over the top of that burner to make it even heat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put the crate around it, a steel crate, and a box for it to blow up into. And I insulated that box real good on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hung that piece of plastic in there and turned that gas on, put an air hose in the bottom of it. And when that got to where we thought it was hot, I'd open that valve on the bottom and it'd blow up like a balloon. Didn't touch nothing. Period. The only thing it touched was where the little double look looks to it at the back, you know, because I stood up a piece of plywood in the middle of it and supported it real good from the top and built the tool around it. So it blew up and hit that. When it hit it, and it was hot. Well, the second it hit that thing and it began to take the shape you wanted, you shut the air valve off, and the air is cooler enough that it stays right there perfect. You just let it cool a few minutes.
I had the honor last fall I was here, and me and Carl Casey worked with you and built the tool, you call it. I call it the mold for the bubble, and I'd like to, when you actually blow that next mold, the bubble, I'd like to maybe come down. I think that would be neat, but yeah, we learned a lot then. What, 3 days that we built that tool. So that was, it was really neat to be a part of that.
Yeah, and I took pictures so we'd know that you guys were a part of it. Yeah. Of you especially.
Yeah, I took a lot of pictures.
So we're going to take a break there and our Daryl Starbird interview. That was the end of part two, and is where we wrapped up right there. That was an absolute amazing time, the week that I spent there with him. 3 days we worked with Carl Casey, KKOA Hall of Famer, another future guest will be coming up, building the tool, as Daryl calls it, for the bubble. I call it a mold, they call it a tool, but it was very, very cool.
Stay tuned for the next episode with Daryl Starbird. We'll be doing one more round with Daryl.